United Airlines. Mr. Newman.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. John Newman for National Processing and National City. There are two questions at issue here. The first and principal one.
Before we get into the merits, we have a little disclosure to make. All three members of the panel have miles in the United Mileage Program, which makes us contingent pre-petition creditors of United Airlines. And I, at least, also hold a ticket for future travel on United Airlines, which makes me a contingent post-petition creditor of United Airlines. Now, we've given some thought to this, and it looks like under Advisory Opinion 101 of the Committee on Codes of Conduct, being a creditor in this form is not treated as a financial interest for purposes of Section 455 and is not disqualifying. But counsel may have given some thought to this matter, and we are certainly willing, indeed eager, to receive any thoughts that you or counsel for United may have about the correct application of Section 455 under the circumstances. I don't want you to do it on your feet, but if either side wants to file post-argument memoranda, understanding that that is the position of your judges, please do so. Okay?
Very well, Your Honor. So two questions, and I would suggest that the first is the principal one, and that is the contract in question here a financial accommodation, or does it have financial accommodation elements in it, and therefore it is non-assumable? Then the second one is, if it is not a financial accommodation, must there be a risk assessment that accompanies the bankruptcy court's determination as to whether to allow it to be assumed? From the record, you know that National Processing is a transaction processor, that National City Bank, with which it is affiliated and affiliated in this contract, is a member of the Visa MasterCard system, that one of the types of processing that National Processing does is with the Visa and MasterCard system, and it is only because of National City Bank, that is, a bank that's the member of that system, that processing can be done through the Visa and MasterCard system. That's the link to the system. That is a financial institution, the bank. And the way the system operates is a Visa MasterCard customer purchases a ticket. United Airlines is able to get cash right away on that ticket, even though it does not deliver the service, oftentimes long delayed, and there is, of course, a spectrum of delay, as the exhibits showed below. It's a substitute, I suggest, and the evidence revealed this, for receivables financing until there was this system for processing in which the so-called merchant bank, which is National City, our client, not the card issuer, but the merchant bank, processes the ticket purchases, processes the credit card receipts, and passes through the money and guarantees the delivery of the service. The way that vendors...
Where is that guarantee represented?
That guarantee is represented, Your Honor, through the rules of the Visa MasterCard system that are incorporated in the merchant contract, the contract that is specified here. Your question suggests, Your Honor, you're quite aware of the debate that occurred below over the proposition that, well...
And is still occurring in the briefs on appeal.
That's for sure, and it might be occurring in your minds and in your question to me. But the fact is, Your Honor, that the way the system operates through the Visa MasterCard system and its rules that are incorporated explicitly in the contract, because you'll see there are many references in the contract to the rules, United's requirement to comply with them, National City's requirement to comply with them, and in fact that the rules to the extent they are in any conflict with other portions of this overall agreement, are what governs here. And so what has happened is that National City and any merchant processor.
Let me tell you the problem this creates, though. I mean, what you're saying is that any form of guarantee is a financial accommodation, and this guarantee can be created not by the consent of the debtor, or indeed not even with the knowledge of the debtor, but if National or National's association just decides to create one behind the debtor's back, voila, the contract becomes non-assumable. Well, even though it's not stated in the contract with the debtor and the debtor never assented to it.
Well, Your Honor, I suggest to you that it's not true that the debtor never assented to it. There's no suggestion here that the rules were somehow created after this contract was entered into or were changed in any way, or that the existence of the rules and their incorporation into the contract and the obligation to abide by the rules and processing according to the rules came as any surprise to United at all. I suggest to you that if United says we didn't know anything about any rules or how the system operated, it's only because they read the contract, they saw a reference to rules, and they didn't care. And they didn't ask. I mean, there's just no question.
No particular reason why they should care as between National and the issuing bank, who bears a particular risk of loss, provided it's not borne by United. But your argument is that now it happens to matter who, as between the issuing bank and the processing bank, bears a risk of loss.
Well, Your Honor, remember, the issuing bank bears a risk of loss at all times with respect to its credit card holder. That's really not at issue here. What we are talking about is bearing the risk of loss for non-delivery of the service.
That risk is going to be borne either by the issuing bank. It's going to be borne by one of three people if United is unable to perform. It's going to be borne by the cardholder, by the issuing bank, or by the intermediary. Now, no particular reason why United should care which of those three bears the risk of loss. And it agreed, you say, by contract, basically to allow the Visa and MasterCard associations to decide for themselves who would bear that risk of loss. But your legal argument is then, having decided to place it with National, that then enabled National to avoid its contract with United.
That's right, Your Honor. Well, it's
but
that's
why should a choice made by National and the Visa National Association have that legal consequence for the debtor if it's not a choice made by the debtor?
Well, Your Honor, the reason why that's the case is that the contract included all these other provisions. The contract referred to the existence of the other provisions in the existence of the rules and the numerous things that the rules for allocation of responsibility and requirements to comply with. And so from the very beginning, all of the things that were part of the rules became a part of this contract. And so United, in signing on to this contract, signed on to everything that was in those rules. I mean, it said, we will comply with the rules, you will comply with the rules. There was no reason, I would suggest.
Well, all right, let's take a hypothetical. Let's suppose the Visa National Association puts in the rules the statement, this contract is not assumable in bankruptcy, notwithstanding anything in the bankruptcy code to the contrary. Has United now assented to that? Agreed to that?
No, Your Honor, in fact.
You put in the association, United's lawyers are forbidden to make the following argument to the bankruptcy court. United, by your view, has agreed to that, and since it's agreed, it can't make the following argument.
Actually, Your Honor, the contract, it's the language of the document that is the contract, not the incorporated rules, does have what you just described in ipso facto clause. United agreed to it. That's not something that is enforceable under the bankruptcy law. We're not arguing for its enforceability. But that very provision is in this very contract, and United assented to it. And my only point here is to tell you that the agreement says there is a set of rules. We all have to abide by these rules too, and those rules talk about where obligations are, where requirements are, where responsibilities are, and so they get incorporated into the agreement, and United said, fine. We agree with that. So I would submit that there is really no question, unless what will be required in the future is that everything that's in the rules not be referred to, but rather be all written out as part of the contract, part of the actual document that's in front of everybody, and not by incorporation by reference. And I think the concept of incorporation by reference is something that's well accepted, and it would come as a big surprise to me, certainly, and I think to the people who were entering into this contract, that incorporation by reference doesn't work in credit card processing agreements. Your Honor, Hamilton, which is the principal case here upon which this decision was turned below, is the only case of an appellate court that has looked at this issue being an issue of first impression in this circuit. There are, of course, major factual distinctions between this case and Hamilton. I think that the real problem in Hamilton is, I suggest to you, a flawed analysis. Hamilton itself acknowledged that there was a guarantee component Hamilton acknowledged that a guarantee would be a financial accommodation. But what it saw there, it didn't analyze in guarantee terms, but rather went on a search of so-called primary purpose. And I suggest to you that that's a kind of metaphysical exercise. That what
it's
we
not
have
really metaphysical. Your point is that they just found the wrong purpose. The purpose of these parties is to make as much money as they can. That's their primary purpose, but of course that doesn't help very much.
But we do know
their primary purpose.
Your Honor, my point would be this, that the concept of you have to search and find a primary purpose and everything else is incidental is the wrong structure for analysis. It's what do we have? There can be two equally important purposes, two equally important functions, or more, not just one. And you don't relegate everything else to incidental. There's a wide gap in between I give you a loan and I sell you a product and you can pay me a couple days later. And in between there are lots of things, and contracts can have a number of different functions. I'm going to cease now to preserve a little bit of time for rebuttal argument, Your Honor, but I simply suggest to you that it is very clear from the record here and from the way this contract functions, from the evidence that was before the court, that this contract doesn't work and United's interests are not served if it doesn't get financing that is guaranteed, or financing that is backed by a guarantee long in advance of when it actually performs the services. And that's the fundamental point here.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Mr. Siv.
May it please the court, this case involves straightforward interpretation of the bankruptcy code. As Mr. Newman made clear, and we agree, there are two principal issues presented by this appeal. First, whether a charge card processing agreement constitutes a financial accommodation under Section 365(c)(2) of the bankruptcy code. And second, whether the bankruptcy code, in deciding whether to allow United to assume that contract, was required to make an assessment of the degree of risk posed to National Processing by allowing that assumption. We would suggest that the answer to both of those questions is no. In other words, this is not a financial accommodation, and the court was not required under Section 365A to make any such risk assessment. And so, therefore, the appeal, the decision below should be affirmed. I'd like to address each of those issues in turn, if I may. First, is the credit card processing agreement a financial accommodation under Section 365(c)(2)? In analyzing that issue, it's important to understand exactly what United was contracting for. United was entering into a standard charge card processing agreement. Indeed, Chief Judge Weedoff below made as a factual finding that this charge card agreement is substantively identical to hundreds of thousands of charge card agreements that merchants enter into across the United States every day. The principal purpose of the agreement, indeed I would suggest the overarching purpose of the agreement, was simply to allow United to...
Agreements can't conceivably have purposes.
Pardon me, Your Honor?
Agreements don't have purposes. People might have purposes, but agreements certainly don't.
Thank you. The United's purpose of entering into the agreement was to enter into a contractual arrangement whereby it would have a mechanism for its customers to purchase its services via a credit card and for national processing to process those credit card transactions. Indeed, as the whereas clause in the contract makes clear, that United's intent in entering into the agreement was simply to allow the airline to accept credit card transactions. There's nothing in the agreement that suggests it is in any way a financing contract. There's no loan provision. There's no suggestion in the contract that there's an advancement of funds by NPC. In fact, the court found below that as a matter of fact, neither National City Bank nor NPC ever advanced its own funds because it was always receiving funds through the Visa and MasterCard Association first before paying those to United. And the court found that there was nothing in the agreement that discusses any guarantee provision or makes reference to any kind of financing arrangement. Now, in determining whether that contract, that charge card processing contract, constitutes a financial accommodation under Section 365C, of course, the place to start is with the language of the statute itself. 365C states simply that contracts are not assumable if they are contracts to make a loan or other debt financing, other debt or financial accommodations. And courts that have examined this precise issue, that is, whether a charge card processing agreement constitutes a financial accommodation, have uniformly held that it does not. The leading case on this issue is the 11th Circuit's decision in Hamilton. The 11th Circuit's decision in Hamilton, I would suggest to this court, is directly on point. It confronted the exact same issue. It was a substantively identical contract in which the court was asked to determine whether or not that contract constituted a financial accommodation. And the court held that it did not, that it is not a financial accommodation and therefore is assumable. And I would suggest to the court that the Hamilton decision is well-reasoned and should be followed by this court. In fact, there are three, I think, broad reasons why that decision makes perfect sense. First, if you look at the structure of the Act as a whole, of the Bankruptcy Act, it's clear that Congress intended the limitation in Section 365C to be a narrow exception to the right of the debtor to assume or reject contracts. And so therefore, the language in Section 365C is to be narrowly construed to promote the debtor's ability to reorganize and to rehabilitate. Second, if you look at the language specifically itself, the language itself makes clear that the term financial accommodation should be interpreted to mean something akin to a loan or other debt financing. Because the statute says that contracts that are not assumable are those that are a loan or other debt financing or financial accommodation. By using the word other, clearly the intent was that the term financial accommodation would have a similar meaning to the terms loan and debt financing.
What do you think a similar meaning is? That is, are you denying that a guarantee is a form of financial accommodation?
I think under certain circumstances it can be, Your Honor. It depends on the contract and the circumstance.
Then I don't understand what it means to be similar to a loan. A guarantee is not similar to a loan.
Well,
a guarantee is on the debtor's side rather than on the creditor's side.
Your Honor, I think what the statute, what was the intent of the statute? What
statutes don't have intents either, and to speak of the intent of Congress is wholly fictive as well. Why don't we just talk about the actual language of the statute?
Happy to, Your Honor. The language itself, when it uses the word other, our position is it was intended by using the term other to make clear that that language was linked to the term loan or other debt financing. In other words, it was akin to or of the same character. In fact, if you apply the statutory construction canon of a justem generis, which we made reference to in our brief, we believe that that's exactly applicable here. It refers to of the same kind. In other words, the canon makes clear that when there's an enumeration of specific things followed by a general word or phrase, the general word or phrase is held to refer to things of the same kind as those specified earlier in the statute. And we believe that that statutory construction principle is applicable here in spades. Your Honor, there's nothing in the language itself which would suggest that contracts that have only an incidental guarantee component, which is at best what this is, were intended to fall within the scope of the statute. I think the 11th Circuit had it directly on when it held that the test here is whether a contract has as its primary purpose the extension of cash or credit.
What do you think that means concretely, given that you agree that contracts don't have purposes and that the purpose of the real contracting parties is simply to make as much money as they can?
Well, I guess I would agree that, Your Honor, I think you need to go beyond just the sort of broad idea that we're all trying to make as much money as we can. Obviously, you have to look at the...
So what does a primary purpose inquiry mean concretely? Right. If you think about a closely held corporation where the principal stockholder or the entrepreneur may give his personal guarantee of the corporate debt, his primary purpose is not to guarantee the debts. He doesn't want to incur legal obligation to pay the corporate debt, but he may have to in order to get his corporation financing and thus make more money. Now, what would you say is the primary purpose of that?
I guess I'm not sure I completely understood your hypothetical. Where there was a
simple guarantee of a corporate debt, the entrepreneur of closely held corporations, that is 99.something% of all corporations, in order to get financing, often must guarantee the corporate debt.
Right.
Right? Now, he doesn't do that because he really wants to pay off the bank if his corporation fails. That's not his purpose. His purpose is to be able to run the corporation, make money as an entrepreneur. Would you say, therefore, that that guarantee is assumable in bankruptcy?
I'd say that guarantee, Your Honor, is closer to a financial accommodation. Because
I'm trying to figure out what you mean by primary purpose.
Well, Your Honor,
the entrepreneur will say, it wasn't my purpose to pay out as much money as I could. My purpose was to make a lot of money through my corporation. If there's to be a primary purpose test, how would we apply it in a case like that?
Your Honor, this court and other courts apply primary purpose tests all the time. In fact, there are...
All right, then you can tell me in a short and simple way how we would apply it in a case like that.
I think what you would do is you would look at what the intent of the parties was as reflected by the contract, Your Honor.
The intent of the entrepreneur is to make as much money as he can without paying out to the bank. But he may be required to make that promise in order to get financing.
I understand in your hypothetical, Your Honor, and I think I acknowledge that your hypothetical, I think, is closer on the line to a financial accommodation, but that's quite different where a company enters into a processing agreement.
It's a classic financial accommodation. It's not closer to the line. It's the core of a financial accommodation.
But that's much different, Your Honor, than what
no,
we have here.
Look, if we've got a standard that makes something that is the core understanding of financial accommodation in law, something that's close to the line and hard to decide, we've got a problem.
Well, Your Honor, I would suggest that you don't need to come up with a bright-line rule that applies to every circumstance.
Primary purpose is not my understanding of a bright-line rule.
Your Honor, I would suggest respectfully that the issue here is a narrow one, and you need not try to come up with a broad rule that could be applied to every contract that might arise in the bankruptcy context. The only issue directly before the court is whether or not a credit card processing agreement falls within the scope of Section 365(c)(2). And that's exactly what the 11th Circuit was looking at in Hamilton, Your Honor. Applying a primary purpose test, while I understand it may be squishy in certain circumstances, is something that courts are asked to do all the time.
But you haven't been able to tell me what it means in any circumstance other than your claim that we win today and devil take the hindmost.
Well, I think that it requires a fact-specific analysis, Your Honor. I think you need to look at each contract to divine what the parties were intending when they entered into the contract. I guess I'm not sure how I could provide a more global definition of what the primary purpose test is without looking at the facts of each case. For example, in the context of class certification under Federal Rule 23b2, this court has held that in determining whether a class can be properly certified, you need to look at whether the primary purpose of the suit is for monetary or injunctive relief. And the court in that case...
I don't believe that we make the contents of people's heads important to that. Our standard is objective.
We ask whether
the damages are objectively incidental. That's very different from a purpose inquiry in which we would try to psychoanalyze the plaintiff's lawyers.
How about under the UCC, Your Honor, when the test about whether or not a contract falls within the UCC is whether or not the primary purpose of the contract is one for goods or services, and a court is asked to try to make a determination in that case as to whether the contract is more closely akin to one for goods or services. I would suggest that that's the same kind of analysis that you're being asked to do here and that courts do all the time. In fact, you can look at the language of the contract. You can look at the, in this case, the title of the contract itself, Charge Card Processing Agreement. And you can look at the specific whereas provisions and what it is each party contracted to do and make a determination based on the contract as to whether or not the parties were intending for that contract to have any kind of loan or debt financing component to it such that it would fall into the class of a financial guarantee. Your Honor, as I said before, we believe that the contract here has no characteristics that would lend itself to becoming a financial accommodation. In fact, I think it's important to point out, we dispute that there's any guarantee component here. And I think it's important to make that point and to highlight the record on that. Judge Weedoff below found that there was nothing in the agreement that suggested that National was a guarantor of United. Rather, he assumed that, as did the 11th Circuit, based on the Visa and MasterCard rules. But those rules were never provided to United, despite our request that they be. And Judge Weedoff had nothing before him other than the assertions of NPC and his counsel to make that determination. I would suggest that he simply assumed that for purposes of the analysis here because it made no difference in the outcome. But we would dispute vigorously that there is any kind of guarantor component that you could find on the evidentiary record in this case. And in fact, I would point out that at least one court, the Standard Financial Management case, has held that it is unconscionable to bind it's unconscionable to bind a debtor to Visa and MasterCard rules which were never provided in which the processor maintains a policy of refusing to produce those and keeping them confidential. The last issue I'd like to address briefly, Your Honor, in my remaining time, is whether or not there's any kind of required risk assessment under Section 365A. I would suggest that there is not. 365A simply says that upon court approval, a debtor may assume a contract. There is nothing in the language of the statute that requires the bankruptcy court to look at the risk that the other party to the contract faces. And I would suggest that Judge Weedoff correctly stated that the concept of unreasonable risk in this particular case really is without meaning. That is, there's no principled way to determine what constitutes an unreasonable risk versus a reasonable risk. So for all these reasons, Your Honor, unless the court has any additional questions, we would urge the court to affirm the decisions below.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Sid. Thank you. Anything further, Mr. Newman?
Mark, can I suggest that instead of looking at purpose, one might look at an element or a function of a contract? That is, does it have certain functions that would be a financial accommodation? And I suggest a potential definition for financial accommodation as providing for or acting as support or backstop for financing, such as via surety, guarantee.
Let's take what I think the 11th Circuit was probably really getting at. And let's go to another bankruptcy we'll hear a small chunk of today, Kmart. Let's assume that Kmart has a contract with one of its vendors, and this contract provides for the provision of merchandise. There are all sorts of ordinary things that would be assumable in bankruptcy, and it's got 100 clauses. The first 99 of them have to do with the provision of merchandise, and clause 100 says, and oh, by the way, we hereby undertake to guarantee $10 of Kmart's debt. At that point, has this contract been made non-assumable in bankruptcy, despite the fact that contracts for the provision of goods are your classic assumable contracts?
Your Honor, I think there that we get to the issue of the meaning of the word incidental, which comes out of the legislative history. It's not in the statute.
The meaning of the word incidental is not very helpful, since the word incidental is not in the statute.
That's correct. And I think, Your Honor, that what you would get to is you
what
would...
What word in the statute would you be construing using incidental?
Your Honor, actually, I agree with that. You look for some kind of a framework, obviously, within which to make...
The framework has been quite clear, including an opinion issued last week, that it is impermissible to consult the legislative history without first identifying an ambiguity in the statute that history will help disambiguate. Referring to legislative history to construe words that don't even appear in the statute is not within our charge.
I would agree with that, Your Honor. I would suggest in the contract...
All right, so what do we do with this 100-clause contract, clause 100 of which guarantees $10?
I would say we are not going to allow that provision to drive our determination.
No, we are not going to allow. What?
The coin
in the statute knocks that out, in your view.
Knocks out what? The contract or the clause, Your Honor?
Prevents that clause from blocking the assumption of contracts in bankruptcy. I assume a lot of Kmart's vendors would have wished, as you wished, that their contract not be assumable. And if your position is right, as I see it, that every vendor in America can rewrite his contract to prevent its assumption in bankruptcy by adding an incidental guarantee.
I suggest to Your Honor, in a practical world, two things would happen there. A court would say, I'm not going to enforce that provision.
Under what part of the statute? Courts just don't have the ability to pick and choose.
You pose a very difficult situation, Your
That's
Honor,
why I want you to
which I acknowledge,
it rather than duck it.
And I think that if a court were to say, which some court might, there is a financial accommodation element of this contract, and since it's either up or down, I will not enforce this contract, and you would immediately have some legislation addressed. Now, I suggest you pose a very difficult case. It's a different case, Your Honor. In this particular circumstance, what we have is a guarantee element of this arrangement between these two parties that is central to the whole contract, and it's central to what United needs as part of the result of using the credit card system.
Okay, we have your position. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.